I'm Krista Tippett. Today, African American woman leader, qualities this presidential election has at times pitted at odds. My guest this hour, Bishop Vashti Murphy McKenzie, holds them all together. She also sheds light on the socially critical tradition of African American Christianity that became a point of political controversy in this election year. We offer her wisdom and good humor as an edifying lens on the American past, present, and future.
I live for the day. I live for the day. I said over and over again, I live for the day. When my gender and my race means nothing, that my gifts, my skills, my character, my mental astuteness, these things qualify me to do the job. Period.
This is Speaking of Faith. Stay with us.
This public radio podcast is supported by the Fetzer Institute as part of its campaign for love and forgiveness. Online at loveandforgive.org.
I'm Krista Tippett. I've been wanting to interview Bishop Vashti Murphy McKenzie all year. The current U.S. election has illustrated how gender, race, and religion can become lightning rods and seen as potential stumbling blocks to leadership. Vashti McKenzie is a pioneering figure on all these fronts and all at the same time. When she became the first woman bishop of the African Methodist Episcopal Church, the oldest of the historic black churches dating back to the early days of the American Republic, she declared, "The stained glass ceiling has been pierced and broken." Vashti McKenzie also sheds light this hour on the socially critical tradition of African American Christianity that became a point of political controversy in this election year. We offer her story, her wisdom, and her good humor as an edifying lens on the American past, present, and future.
I live for the day. I live for the day. I said over and over again, I live for the day. When my gender and my race means nothing, that my gifts, my skills, my character, my mental astuteness, these things qualify me to do the job. Period.
From American Public Media, this is Speaking of Faith, public radio's conversation about religion, meaning, ethics, and ideas. Today, African American woman leader. Meeting Vashti Murphy McKenzie. Vashti McKenzie was ordained a bishop in 2000 and now leads the 13th Episcopal District of the African Methodist Episcopal Church, or AME. The roots of the AME were laid in 1787 when preacher and former slave Richard Allen and other black Methodists walked out of a church in Philadelphia to protest their treatment by whites. For Vashti McKenzie, religion was just one supportive aspect of an altogether empowering upbringing. Her great-grandfather founded a chain of African-American newspapers in 1892. Her maternal grandfather, Carl Murphy, had five daughters and raised them to carry on the family business. Vashti McKenzie at first followed in this tradition, becoming a broadcaster and corporate vice president of programming at a TV station. She married an NBA basketball star, Stan McKenzie, who's been her husband now for 40 years and with whom she has three children. Then in the late 1970s, she preached her first sermon at a pulpit in her native Baltimore and knew that this was her life's calling. Yet through all her accomplishments, Vashti McKenzie has experienced the crosshairs, as she puts it, of racism and sexism.
I have been female and African American all my life. When I look back over the places where I've been in life, I have not been in traditionally places, roles, functionalities that were traditionally female, except for, I think, one time. But doing morning drive was not, a traditional place for a woman to be. Being a program director in a major market, Washington, D.C., and we got good ratings, yay, but that was not a traditional role for women. Being a general manager radio station at the time was not a traditional role for a woman. So to be able to face the jokes, you'd come into work and your program director now. So now you're going off shift, and you're going to handle the administrative responsibilities and duties, and the next person coming behind you, I give a little reminder. I said, don't forget to leave the studio the way you found it. And so the young man said to me, but you can't tell me what to do because a woman is not supposed to tell a man what to do. And I said, excuse me. Right. I'm your program director. I signed your checks, you know. Pardon me. And he says, well, the Bible says that a wife is supposed to submit herself to her husband. Yeah. And I said, am I married to you? And he says, no. Then make sure the studio looks like this when you go off shift. You know? And it's those kinds of things that you face on a daily basis. You know, those kinds of things. And it becomes very disappointing when you believe that you're holding hands with your brothers who are of African descent, who you believe that together we're going to help open the doors for the generation that are coming behind us. Mm. And together we're going to work to be sure that people don't look at our color first, but they look at our skills, our qualifications, our education, our background. And then all of a sudden, the hand that you're holding turns around and closes the door in your face because you're a woman. Mm. See? And so that what it means is being in the crosshairs. It's sort of like a double whammy. You know, you get, bam, you get hit because of your color. And then you get hit again because of your gender.
Now, you were, is this right, you were in sixth grade when integration arrived in Baltimore?
Yes.
How did that imprint your sense of what it meant to be African-American culturally? I mean, did that make you more aware of your race than you had been before?
Yes. I believe that, you know, growing up in Baltimore, we were in a very wonderful community where we knew everybody in the neighborhood, and it was a wonderful, affirming place. In school, your school teachers were likely to be the same persons who were your Sunday school teachers. It's like a unit between the church, the school, and the community. It was a wonderful incubator, you know, just a mm-hmm. wonderful incubator. Then all of a sudden, integration comes, and we are bused across town to a new school where instead of being a part of a majority, you are a part of a minority. Mm-hmm. You may be the only person who is of African descent in your class. There may be two or three of you. I don't remember. I believe there were only about 7 to 10 kids in this humongous elementary school where I finished the sixth grade. And, of course, they couldn't get my name right. I was Vashti, and I kept saying, no, I am Vashti, and or you're Washti, and no, and I said, you know, and the kids in the class, well, why didn't your mother name you Mary or Ann like the rest of us? Because my name is not Mary or Ann like the rest of you. It is Vashti. Well, we have to find a name. We have to call you something. We just can't call you your name. And then all of a sudden, you become an oddity, and there was really a new experience. You find yourself in a position where you have to teach people about your culture and your heritage because they didn't know.
That's not an easy thing to do when you're in sixth or seventh or eighth grade, when you're wrestling with your identity at such a fundamental level as well.
Mm-hmm. Well, at that point, you find that you have to prove yourself every day. Before then, you were just you. Here you are. You're in class with teachers who, you know, looked at you and expected you to do great things. Then you're thrust into an environment where people expect you to fail. They look for you to fail. They look for you to be in the lowest reading group. They look for you to do the worst in math. And so you find you have to prove different. The school was wonderful because it had a whole lot of other things that we didn't have. You know, I was at Robert Brown Elliott School Number 104, which at the top of the school in stone, it said Colored School Number 9. All we had was a playground and a cafeteria. But at this new school, there was a gymnasium. We never had a gymnasium before. They had a band. track and field outside, out back. I mean, it was like, wow. You know, they had all these kinds of things that we didn't have in our elementary school, which was wonderful, you know. But I was already taking piano lessons. And so when I got to that school, they says, well, we already have a student playing piano. You have to learn another instrument. I said, okay, fine. And you find that in every place that you're put, you have to prove your existence, that you have a right to be there. And that's what African Americans, and that's what women do every day in a leadership position. You have to prove that you have a right to be there.
Bishop Vashti McKenzie, I'm Krista Tippett, and this is Speaking of Faith from American Public Media. Today, African American woman leader. Before Vashti McKenzie became the first female bishop of the African Methodist Episcopal Church, she spent 10 years as the first female pastor of the historic Payne Memorial Church in Baltimore. As she was about to accept that call in 1990, one bishop pulled her aside to question her readiness. He said, she's written, that my failure would not just be my personal failure. It would mean that a woman would not be appointed to such a charge for a very long time. Under Vashti McKenzie's leadership, Payne Memorial not only grew, it launched multiple community projects, including a human and economic development center with a senior adult daycare and a Head Start program. Payne Memorial also secured a $1.5 million welfare-to-work contract with the state of Maryland. This kind of social engagement is a contemporary expression of the traditional role of African American churches as a hub of common life, not just worship. Vashti McKenzie says this kind of action is essential in light of her theology and the African Methodist Episcopal Church's sense of mission.
You know, seek out and save the lost, visit the sick, cheer the fallen, encourage thrift, economic thrift, housing, visit those who are in prison. And these are, you know, these are biblically based. These are not things that were just grabbed out of the air. When you go to Matthew, the 25th chapter, when Jesus says, when the people respond, when did we see you hungry? Yeah. When did we see you in prison? And the Lord's response is, as you have done it unto the least of these, you've done it unto me. Mm-hmm. For me, the church ought to be a center of the community. And being in the community, then our responsibility are not only to those who are members of your church, our responsibility is also to those who live in the shadow of, I call it the shadow of your citadel. And so there is a neighborhood, there is a community of needs and beings. And so the church ought to respond to that. And being at Payne, and you must understand, every church I pastored, I was the first woman.
Okay.
It's not just Payne.
All right.
Every church along the way.
Okay.
I was the first woman to pastor that congregation. I'm excited to say that I was not the last woman to pastor. But being in Payne Memorial in that Northwest Baltimore area, that congregation, for the most part, people drove in from other neighborhoods to attend that congregation. They used to live around there. But around that neighborhood, there was violence, there was crime, there was drug activity, there was prostitution. There were people who were hungry, people who were homeless on the street. So what are we supposed to do? Drive in, have our wonderful service, and go home?
Okay.
And not do anything to enhance the life of those who live around your congregation. And so then our job is to be sure that the power that is on the inside becomes the power that reaches the people on the outside. So that means you do more than have a food pantry where once a week people who are hungry can come with a sack and we give you non-perishable food items. You have to go beyond that. You know, it's like, I saw you last week. Now, what are you going to do this week to be sure you're not in my line next week?
Right.
What can we do to help you and empower you next week?
And so that was your welfare to work programming that you started.
it's a natural lead-in. The outreach center, started with, of course, the food pantry and the clothes pantry, the traditional things that happen. And then we moved to helping people with their shut-off and cut-off notices. And then we became like the referral agency. I need help, okay? Let's see how we can connect you to the appropriate agency or organization in the community, in the city, that can help you with that need, because some people just can't navigate all the red tape that they face when they need help, or they don't know where to go to help. And so the natural progression was to move into a place where we train persons for jobs and, held their hands while they navigated coming out of tennis shoes and jeans, and we had a professional clothes closet. We did soft skills, how to get your resume out, how to do an interview, how to do all those kind of things, and then go through the training program. So we did all of the prep work.
It really helped connect the dots, very practical dots.
And it's called demonstrating the love of God in tangible and practical ways.
You became a bishop. That was your next move from Payne Memorial.
That's correct.
And so now in the African Methodist Episcopal Church, as in many Protestant churches, you feel a calling to run for, you run for bishop. It's kind of a political process. It's not an appointment from on high. So tell me, did you start to feel that calling to a broader leadership in those experiences you're describing? Is that something you can
yes.
trace?
Yeah, I believe that there is a call to the episcopacy. I believe it's more than a decision. You just don't wake up in the morning and say, well, I've done this long enough. It's time for me to go do something else. Or, I'm ready for the next level of service. I believe that just as there's a call to preach and there's a call to pastor, there's a call to teach. I believe there's a call to episcopal service. Because the road to being elected is not an easy one. It's not an easy one for your family, and it's not an easy one for you. It is a political process. You have to campaign. Every 4 years, the AME Church holds a general conference. There are delegates who come from all over the world, from, of course, the United States, the Caribbean, England, Europe, Africa, Canada. They come from all over the world, and they will elect episcopal leaders. And so you have to present yourself to these delegates because they're going to vote for you. And it means you're going to have to travel. You're going to have to go to outside
of your
annual
conference.
You're
going to have to hit the campaign
trail. Yeah, you got to hit the campaign trail. And that's exactly what you do. And there, of course, we have campaign workers. You got volunteers. You got T-shirts. You got banners.
Videos. I heard you had a great video that greeted people at the convention about your life and ministry.
The whole thing is, how do I get the message to people beyond the political barriers? It's the same thing that the candidates are doing now.
Yeah.
But my campaign was on my track record, my experience. And I told people, don't elect me because I'm a woman. Elect me because I'm qualified to do the job. Elect me if you want me to be your bishop, because, one day I just might be. I haven't served all my life, haven't worked all my life to be a novelty, to be a token anything, just to dress up the stage, to be the feminine presence and all of this kind of thing.
Seems to me that you had a pretty challenging or at least stretching adventure. Your first appointment as bishop, you went to serve as the chief pastor of the 18th Episcopal District in Southeast Africa. And so you were in Lesotho and Swaziland, Botswana, Mozambique. But tell me how that time in Africa continued to evolve and shape your theology and your understandings of ministry and leadership.
Well, Africa was and is a great place to do ministry, because there are so many needs, and it's not difficult to convince people, we have a problem here. Yes, we have a problem. Now, let us all come together and see how we're going to solve the problem. They're going to say, yes, let's go, which is different. When you're in the United States and you say, have you noticed the neighborhood is decaying and we really ought to do something about it? And they'll say, we'll go home to the suburbs and we'll think about it and we'll come back. And when we have official board, we'll discuss it. You know, you're in Africa and there was the HIV/AIDS pandemic, and you have, in that southern region, you had 7,000 people dying every week, and church life is interrupted because pastors and people have to pull together resources to bury people. And you had children who were left by the roadside or who were left on the steps of hospitals that are already overburdened. And you have 10-year-olds raising their 3- and 5- and 6-year-old siblings because their parents are in various stages of death and dying. I've seen poverty in the United States. I've seen what poor is. I've seen hunger here. I've seen homeless here. But you have never seen poverty as it is in Africa. It will break your heart.
Did that put you more in touch with the prophetic tradition of the African-American church in particular?
You mean African Methodist Episcopal
Church? Well, yeah, but even I think African-American theology in general in the United States has, it's in the Bible, okay, but I mean in terms of churches that have retained that at their core, I think that's more true of African-American theology in the United States, perhaps. Did it awaken that in you or deepen that in you?
I couldn't say it awakened in me because I felt that I've been at it all along in the prophetic social gospel tradition all along. And so it's a continuum. It says, yeah, you're right on course. You are, you know, you're right in line. You are stepping in the right direction in your preaching, in your theology, in your approach to ministry.
Here is Bishop Vashti Murphy McKenzie preaching at the Washington National Cathedral in January. She's expounding on the biblical story of the 40 years the ancient Israelites spent in the desert after they had been liberated from Egypt before they reached the Promised Land. The Exodus story of the Israelites' liberation from slavery and their guiding figure of Moses are pivotal in African-American biblical interpretation and theology.
In other words, God said to Moses, enough is enough, and Moses turned around and told the people the same thing. And so, if we're talking about the pursuit of happiness, it appears that God indicates that direction is just as important as destination. The destination was set, the promised place of God. They knew where it was located. They were in the general vicinity for more than 3 decades. It wasn't a new destination, and neither were the people just informed about it. For the promised place of God was in their mission statement for 400 years and a part of the strategic plan at least for 38. They didn't know where to go. They knew where it was, but they just couldn't get there. And so all they were doing was going around and around in circles. They were marking time in merry-go-round agendas. Do you think we do the same now? Is God saying to us this morning, enough is enough? You've been going around in circles long enough. Merry-go-round agendas with the lives of people. Merry-go-round agendas where everybody, some people have everything and everybody, others have nothing. Going around in merry-go-round circles where race and gender qualifies you or disqualifies you for an office, whether it's the president of the United States or the president of the Eatin', Meetin', Greetin' Club. We know the destination, our direction is confused. And God says we have walked around in circles long enough. You see, they were delivered, but they were not free. There's that word again. They were delivered, but they were not free.
Vashti McKenzie preaches with her whole body. So we've posted video of her preaching this past Easter Sunday at Trinity United Church in Chicago, the former congregation of Senator Barack Obama. You can watch her speak about the need for prophetic passion in American Christianity and witness how her words resonate with that predominantly African-American congregation. And we also wrote about the rigorous task of researching and selecting audio clips of Vashti McKenzie's preaching. Read a behind-the-scenes account of that process on our blog, SOF Observed. And tell us what you think. We want to know not only if we hit the mark, but how these selections resonated with you. Look for links on our homepage, speakingoffaith.org. After a short break, Vashti McKenzie sheds light on the prophetic tradition of preaching and social criticism to which she belongs and which came to public attention in soundbite form when scrutiny focused on Jeremiah Wright, the former minister of Trinity United Church of Christ. Also, her thoughts on life beyond the election. I'm Krista Tippett. Stay with us. Speaking of Faith comes to you from American Public Media.
Speaking of Faith is supported by the Fetzer Institute as part of its campaign for love and forgiveness, online at loveandforgive.org, and by Gather.com, where friends keep up with the people, conversations, and moments that matter most. Public radio listeners are talking at Gather.com.
Welcome back to Speaking of Faith, Public Radio's conversation about religion, meaning, ethics, and ideas. I'm Krista Tippett. Today, African-American woman leader meeting Bishop Vashti Murphy McKenzie. Vashti McKenzie is bishop of the 13th Episcopal District of the African Methodist Episcopal Church, or AME. In 2004, she was also elected president of the Council of Bishops of the AME, yet another first as a woman. Her life reflects a convergence of themes that have come to the surface of American life during the current presidential campaign: race, gender, leadership, and religion. Vashti McKenzie values the prophetic tradition of socially activist thought and preaching. This became a focus of political analysis and controversy when portions of sermons of Senator Barack Obama's former pastor, Jeremiah Wright, were publicized this past spring. Vashti McKenzie has long known Jeremiah Wright as a friend and has preached across the years at his former church, Trinity United Church of Christ in Chicago. I do want to ask you about some of the issues that were raised in our culture, but I think not anywhere near resolved, around the person of Jeremiah Wright in the context of Barack Obama's presidential campaign. And I don't want to talk so much, you know, about him, but about, here's what, you know, one question I'd like to ask you is just how you experienced that conflict. You know, what you longed for people to have a better grasp of, to be able to put any of that into context. I've kind of asked you a bunch of questions there, but we know wherever you'd like to weigh in. Yeah.
Sure. First one was, how was the experience? It was painful. Mm-hmm. It was very, very painful to watch and hear and listen the negative firestorm that came at the end of a successful pastoral ministry. Very painful. And a lot of it was only because Senator Obama was a member of that congregation. Secondly, I don't think people understand Black theology.
Yeah.
They need to read Cone's books and all the others. And I think Cone did an excellent job in interviews and others in sharing.
James Cone, right.
Mm-hmm. About theology, Black theology. And the reason why I say, you know, it is the lens. In other words, theology is the system through which you evaluate and interpret scripture or ministry and all of that. And then there is a thought of universal theology. In other words, the universal human experience. But for many African Americans and for women, they are not a part of that universal experience. And so the starting point for your interpretation, the starting point for building your theology comes out of the African American experience.
Okay.
Just as womanist theology begins with the woman experience as the starting point of building the lens through which you interpret. So I think a lot of people don't understand it, and there are some people who grabbed it and ran with it in a direction that sort of startled everybody. And, you know, preacher after preacher and bishop after bishop through the years had preached similar things, but nobody raked them over the coals. And, of course, the thing that was on YouTube that I guess that started the whole ball rolling was not what he was saying. He was quoting someone else who was not African American.
Right. And what I'm just trying to cast my mind back. It was linking the events of September 11th in a broad historical perspective with American actions in the rest of the world. It was,
sure.
Right? It was making connections between
right.
events
and
moral culpability. Right. And it wasn't his thought.
It wasn't his thought.
He was expounding on it.
Mm-hmm. What someone else said from another ethnic position. I was in Africa for 9/11. And I never feared for my life as an American anywhere in the world, except for during that season. Serving in Africa for those 4 years, I was able to view the United States through the eyes of someone else other than American media. I found the BBC, the Chinese news, you know, all the other countries, Italian news service, French news service, Spanish news service, you know, able to hear what they said about my country. And in fact, you have a totally different picture of your home when you see it through other eyes. And you're watching the media, you're watching American media, you know, covering the same issues and the same story. I was going, wow, this is very subjective.
Okay.
I said, oh, this is not objective at all. This is very subjective. So on one hand, you know, it's like, let us entertain you. And then on the other hand, this is what you have to be afraid of today.
And, okay, so prophetic preaching is the opposite of entertaining.
You're not going to let me talk about this, are you?
No, I am. But if you want to come back, if you think I'm derailing you, don't let me. But what I was going to say is what felt inflammatory when people heard sections of Jeremiah Wright's sermons on YouTube and really things taken out of context, it was that combination of seeing things in a different way, but also the anger and the righteous indignation that is part of the prophetic tradition. And it was that passion attached to the idea that maybe America was morally culpable in the large sweep of history, and maybe there was some connection between that and bad things that were happening to us now, that struck a really emotional nerve in the American psyche of something being almost anti-American. So what did you want people to understand about that kind of preaching and that kind of theology?
Well, I have to come back.
I have to come back.
You know, I've got to come back and say that from any pulpit in America, whether the preacher is Black, white, Asian, yellow, blue, pink, or green, whatever color, you will hear somewhere, some strain of criticism or opinion about America. You will hear it. I hear it when I, you know, go through the channels and I listen and I listen and I listen, you know, and I hear a preacher say, you vote for those who believe in your values. Or you switch the channel and you hear the preacher says, now we're going to support our troops, right or wrong. Okay, here's this opinion here. You hear a variety of things, not okay. just in the black church. Mm-hmm. You hear a variety of opinions that support a particular political line, a political bent, you know, a political thing. It's not just in the black church. I'm saying it is in all churches.
Okay.
What happens in America is we have an opinion that we can't do anything wrong, that everything we do is right. Hmm?
We as a culture.
Mm-hmm. 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 What do you think?
What do I think?
Yeah.
I'm a journalist. You know, I don't have any opinions.
Yeah, right.
When Americans hear those kinds of opinions in the pulpit, the other kind of opinion, that we support our troops, right or wrong, that sounds patriotic. And now what I hear you doing is being patriotic in a sophisticated and complex way. But I think you're still saying that in the pulpit, it's appropriate to point out that everything is not perfect with American democracy. I mean, you know, so take what you just said to me and tell me what is the place for that kind of analysis in the pulpit and in preaching and how that comes together with this prophetic tradition.
Well, the prophetic tradition is one thing. If you're talking about social criticism and whether social criticism has a place in the preaching tradition, yes. Does political criticism, I think that's what you're asking now, whether political criticism belongs in the pulpit. I think you'll find a lot of opinion that says, no, we preach Jesus Christ, him crucified and risen from the grave. You know, that is our mandate. That is the gospel ministry. But to be silent about what's happening in your neighborhood, is that sin? So for me, if I'm in my neighborhood, let's say I'm back in Baltimore, I'm at Payne Memorial, I'm the pastor, and I have 5,000 people who cannot feed their families. And I look up and I've got another 5,000 coming because they're being dropped out of a system. Then I'm supposed to be silent and not pick up the phone and call my council representative or my mayor and say, this is what's happening in my neighborhood. What can we do together to fix this? Because in a minute, it's getting ready to be out of hand.
Okay.
And they tell me, well, we made these decisions months ago and years ago. And I said, but you made these decisions and you expect me to feed these people and take care of them and be a part of the safety net system. That means now you're impacting my budget, my tithes and offerings that are going to go for my people to help fix this problem that you created and didn't bother to consult me.
Mm-hmm.
So you want me to shift my budget to be a part of the safety net because we're going to do that anyway. You know, we're going to demonstrate the love of God in a very tangible way. But I'm supposed to do that silently? And not ask questions to see how we can make sure this doesn't happen again?
Bishop Vashti McKenzie, the lens of black theology, as Vashti McKenzie said, is influentially explored in the writing of James Cone of New York City's Union Theological Seminary. Here is James Cone being interviewed earlier this year at the Trinity Institute of the Episcopal Parish of Trinity Wall Street in New York.
Now, you come to this reading the scriptures, the same scriptures that the dominant white church read. How can people read Holy Scripture so differently? How do you read the scriptures?
I read the scripture from the bottom. That is, I read the scriptures from the vantage point of the weak, the poor, and the helpless. I think that's the dominant theme in the scriptures. I think you see that in Amos and a lot of the prophets. I think you see that in the Exodus, that symbol. I think you see that in the story of Jesus' life and certainly in the cross. I think you have to read the scripture through the eyes of those who are marginal, weak, helpless in this society. But everybody doesn't read it that way. And the people who don't read it that way are usually the people who are already on top. They are the advantage. Now, there are many voices in the scripture. And you have to choose. What the scripture doesn't do is self-interpret. You have to make a choice. I choose, by looking at the scriptures from the vantage point of the cross, a violent event, an event in which the helpless Christ, Lord, is hanging there. I think that is close to a lynch black victim than it is to somebody who is sitting up in some mansion somewhere.
Watch that entire interview with James Cone on our website, speakingoffaith.org. I'm Krista Tippett, and this is Speaking of Faith from American Public Media. Today, African-American woman leader meeting Bishop Vashti Murphy McKenzie. Ask you a similar question to the one I asked at the beginning of this, talking about Jeremiah Wright. There was a point in the primary campaign, and this is when I started thinking about wanting to interview you, where there were suddenly, it was like the notion of being a woman leader, being an African-American leader, somehow there was a competition between the two in a sense. Well, which would be best? And I started thinking about Vashti McKenzie, who is an African-American woman leader, and how you hold all those qualities together in yourself. And I just want to ask you also how you experienced some of the dynamics that were raised about gender and about race in that primary period, how you personally took that in, what disturbed you, what did you feel we weren't really addressing head on?
Well, I still feel that there's still more emphasis on whether one is black or whether one is female, and that our focus should be upon the issue, the program, the platform, the track record, and then again, the things that need to be done to look ahead. I mean, we have issues that need to be dealt with, and they need to be dealt with effectively, not only for our future, but for our children's future. We have a domestic policy that is kind of ragged here, and we already know what's happening on Wall Street, stock market. Yeah. Our government is bailing out the financial system here, private financial organizations, to keep it from getting worse. But then you wonder who's going to bail out the American government. You begin to wonder, is America for sale? And these are very tenuous times in our country, and we're all hoping for the best and the better. So we should not be focusing on whether one is a female or whether one is African American. Let's focus on what they say they can do, what the policy can be, how can they perform. That should be the focus. And I live for the day. I said over and over again, I live for the day when my gender and my race means nothing about whether I'm qualified to do a job or perform a task, that my gifts, my skills, my character, my mental astuteness, these things is what gets me in the door, not whether I'm female or not whether I'm African American, not whether I'm from the Asian Pacific Rim, not whether I'm Hispanic or Latino, but my gifts, my skills, my graces, these things qualify me to do the job. Period.
You often write about, leaders who happen to be women. And I can imagine you also leaders who happen to be African-American or happen to be Latino.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when the ship is sinking and you're going down for the third time, okay? You know, somebody's getting ready to cast a net to say, you know, I can pull this ship out of the water and all of you will live. Are you going to stand there and take time and say, are you African-American? You know, what's your heritage? What's your parentage? Right. You just want to get, you want to get saved. You want to live. You want to get out of the rough waters here. You don't want to drown.
You talk a lot in your books about it's important for you for people to think for themselves about what are societal defining moments for them. And I'd just love to know what your perspective is, you know, in these years we're in now. Because I have a feeling you may not give the obvious answers. You know, what are the societal defining moments that you see, that you're experiencing, that are going to shape us as we move forward well beyond, you know, this year, this presidential election and the crises of today?
I think that you're referring to when I talk about defining moments, things that happen so that things are different after that moment happens. They have impact upon your life so that how you were living prior to it was changed by that moment so that you live differently after that. Like certainly for me, the assassination of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. was a defining moment for me. And I think in this era, this election, whoever wins, it's going to be a defining moment. Mm. I believe that because there's so many young people, hooray, 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 who have been content to let other people make decisions for them, who are waking up and who are working and volunteering and getting excited. And there's going to be one group that's disappointed. And my fear is that they would just throw up their hands and walk away.
Yeah.
And that they're unable to handle it. And I would hate for that to happen. I would hope that whichever side, whatever it is, that they would use that disappointment to continue to participate and to work and to volunteer and, of course, to vote. This is a most exciting time to be alive in the world. We are right on the cusp of moving into new directions. We are learning, moving from this industrial age to this information age, which is changing all of our relationships. Mm-hmm. And I think the church is the last place where we're going to learn how to relate to each other as human beings.
You mean it's the last place, it's one of the last places where that is what we focus on? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, where it's taught, mm-hmm. where it's preached, where it's taught, where you learn it, where you're in Sunday school. Mm-hmm. We don't do it in school anymore.
Yeah, it's intergenerational, too, in churches.
Yeah, mm-hmm. absolutely, on how we relate to each other. But for me, I remember very vividly, my dad, big guy, 6'4", 200-pound guy, you know, AAU track champion out of the University of Wisconsin, big guy. You know, your daddies are always a little girl's hero. And I vividly watched my dad watching the dogs and the hoses released on people who were in the freedom marches down south with tears coming down his eyes. And I was a little girl, and he turned to me and he says, never let anybody ask you what you did for your people and for your country. And so I never want my children to ask me, what did you do? I want them to be able to see it. And I hope every adult who is living and alive today will be able to do something to improve where we live and who we are, so that when you turn around and hand this world to your children, you will not be ashamed. Thank you.
The Right Reverend Vashti Murphy McKenzie is presiding prelate of the 13th Episcopal District of the African Methodist Episcopal Church. She is based in Nashville, Tennessee. She has authored several books, including Not Without a Struggle: Leadership Development for African American Women in Ministry. My interview with Vashti McKenzie, visit our website, speakingoffaith.org. There you can download an MP3 of my unedited conversation with her, as well as this program for free. Or subscribe to our podcast and we'll deliver them directly to your desktop. And on our staff blog, SOF Observed, we're looking to you for ideas. Everything from how we might explore the ethical and moral boundaries of our developing economic crisis to suggestions for music for an upcoming program on revenge and forgiveness. Scientists are exploring how and why revenge and forgiveness are biologically driven instincts. They are in our DNA. My guest in that program says that if we better understand our capacity for revenge, then we can nurture our capacity for forgiveness. We're looking for your stories of revenge, of forgiveness, and of what you've learned in your experience of them both. Look for links to share your story and SOF Observed on our website, speakingoffaith.org. Senior producer of Speaking of Faith is Mitch Hanley, with producers Colleen Scheck, Shiraz Janjua, and Rob McGinley Myers, with assistance from Amara Hark Weber. Our online editor is Trent Gillis, with web producer Andrew Dayton. Kate Moose is the managing producer of Speaking of Faith, and I'm Krista Tippett.
Speaking of Faith is supported by the Fetzer Institute as part of its campaign for love and forgiveness, online at loveandforgive.org. Additional funding is provided by the Ford Foundation, a resource for innovative people and institutions worldwide, on the web at fordfound.org. The Luce Foundation's Henry R. Luce Initiative on Religion and International Affairs. And the George Family Foundation, funding innovative ideas in integrative medicine, education, and spirituality in everyday life. Speaking of Faith is extending its reach throughout America with support from Lilly Endowment, an Indianapolis-based private foundation.
Next time, with the presidential election approaching, Americans remain divided about how much religion they want in their political life. Journalist Stephen Waldman has done an unusual study of how the culture wars have skewed contemporary American sense of how we came to have religious liberty in the first place, what it really means, and how to preserve it. Please join us for the next Speaking of Faith.
American Public Media.